Did you see the stylish kids in the riot? Shoveled up like monks at the night on fire, wombles bleed, truncheons and shields. You know I cherish you, my love.
Welcome to the Young IPA Podcast. I'm James, this is Pete.
Great to see you, everyone.
Ooh, great to see you. Yeah, episode 82. Got a big show for you guys coming up. We're going to be talking to Morgan Begg, research fellow here at the IPA, foe of the show. I think we've now confirmed it.
Yep.
And Kurt Wallace. Too early to tell whether friend or foe of the show.
Kurt's a
good introduction. So friend it for the moment, but open to anything. Kurt Wallace, another research fellow here at the IPA, in week two of his time here at the IPA. So we're just going to be, it's getting to know Kurt.
Yeah,
hopefully, like, you guys are going to be seeing a lot coming up, working on your dignity of work projects, a lot of industrial relations stuff. So yeah, get to know Kurt.
We gave him a real baptism of fire.
We did. So yeah, one of our, one of our inside the IPA shows, a lot of IPA guests. We do have some pretty big guests coming up.
Like as big as you can imagine.
Yeah, sorry, but only if our listeners are good. So that's all I'm going to say. It'd be a real shame. It'd be a real shame if Pete and I were to look at our iTunes rankings and see the same amount of five-star reviews as usual. Yeah. It'd be a real shame. That's all I'm saying. Sorry, let's get into it. The big story in Australian politics this week is moving the embassy to Jerusalem. So yeah. The Morrison government announced that it will now consider recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. Like, basically, our embassy at the moment's in Tel Aviv. There's a whole lot of things going on here. So the IPA's got two articles you might want to read, which I'm going to read from here. So we've got Matthew Lesh talking about it, and also John Roscombe's article in the Australian Financial Review this morning was on it. So Matthew Lesh is one. I mean, it's a huge issue. So Trump last year moved the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, and that was going to be a huge political issue. Australia said it wouldn't at this stage, and now they're flagging that they would. So Matthew Lesh, very optimistic about this.
Matthew Lesh in Fairfax yesterday.
Yes, very optimistic about this. He calls it a welcome reiteration of our liberal democratic values in foreign policy. He goes on to say, Israel's capital is Jerusalem. Jerusalem is the home of Israel's parliament and the administrative apparatus and the president and the prime minister. Israel is the only country that does not get to select its own capital and have that recognized by other nations. It would be strange for Australia's American embassy to be located in New York and Washington, D.C., and not Washington, D.C., or at a British High Commission to be in Manchester and London. Mm-hmm. First off, I prefer New York to Washington, D.C., and Pete, I'm sure too. Because of the music, you'd prefer Manchester to London.
That's true.
So they wouldn't be the worst things in the world.
So maybe a bit of a flaw in Matthew's.
Yeah, so I would have picked a few other countries there. But then, so you got John Roscombe, a bit more sceptical. Obviously, John Roscombe supports the policy, as do I, and I don't want to speak for Pete, but how do you feel about it?
I've got a few reasons why I support it, which I'll get to in a sec.
Okay, very cool. Something for the listeners to look forward to.
Yeah, but don't switch off.
Sorry, but John Roscombe's article in the AFR, he says this is probably linked to Wentworth by-elections coming up this weekend.
Yep.
And he says, if the Liberals lose Wentworth and we never hear again about the embassy being moved because it was just like a thing thrown to help the election, the PM will have succeeded in revealing that the Liberals' commitment to furthering democracy and freedom around the world is as skin deep as a by-election campaign promise. And then he says, like, this is the Liberal Party engaging in identity politics, which he doesn't like. I really hope that we do this, and I do hope that it's not just the throwaway by-election promise and then we never hear about it again if the Liberals lose, or if they win and they go, well, now it's a bit too hard. I mean, to me, it's like, as long as a good policy wins out, I don't quite care what the political space was in which it was created. Yeah. So if we do move, and like, I don't care if Wentworth wins or loses, but as long as the embassy moves, I'm happy.
Yeah, I mean, obviously that's the massive suspicion of it, isn't it? That's just because there is a large Jewish population in Wentworth, which I think is what they're trying to gain the support of.
Yeah.
There's a couple of reasons why I support this. I think that, Matt also included in his article yesterday, of the 97 resolutions between UN resolutions between 2012 and 2015, 83 were against Israel. 83. Now, no country is perfect, but you can't tell me that Israel is worse than, you know, Venezuela, Saudi Arabia, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, where would you rather live? Yeah, exactly. Is what I always come back to.
Exactly right. So, and the other thing is, it's like, okay, fine, Jerusalem's in dispute. You know, I get that. But even in every scenario of a two-state solution, there'll still be embassies in Jerusalem.
Yeah.
So it's like, we're allowing ourselves to be pushed around by these states that A, don't think Israel should exist, and B, treat, in many circumstances, their own citizens appallingly. And it doesn't make sense.
Absolutely. So if you guys want to hear more about what IPA staffers are thinking about, IPA staff members are thinking about this policy, make sure you're going to ipa.org.au, reading John's article and also Matthew's one. They're both on the front page.
Yep.
Pete, let's move on to another topic.
Well, I want to talk to you about company tax rates, James.
Oof.
So they announced during the week that they were going to go ahead with the tax cuts for companies with a turnover under $50 million. There's a few different problems with this. We talked about it a little bit in Hey What Did I Miss yesterday. The thing is, they're going to tax people for under $50 million turnover of 25%, and over $50 million, 30%, which means that if you earn $49 million, if your turnover is $49 million and you have a profit of $10 million, you will have a higher after-tax profit than if you earn have a turnover of $1 million more and the same profit, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. The stat I saw was going $1 past that $50 million threshold would hit the turnover cliff, making you immediately liable for an additional $125,000 in company tax.
Yeah.
It's a hit.
Yeah, so it doesn't work like income tax where, you know, only your income over that amount gets taxed because it's all of it, which we were like upstairs yesterday on level 3 at the IPA, and we were like, hang on, that can't be right. And Simon actually rang his mate at the Treasury to confirm if that was true or not, and they were like, yep, it's true. So it's amazing. So then
follow-up question, really?
Yeah. Something like that. But Morgan Begg got his abacus out and did those calculations that we featured in Hay yesterday with the after-tax profit. It depends what the...
Morgan stopped believing in technological development after the abacus. He'd seen enough.
Yeah.
That was good enough for
I
him.
I got me numbers, so...
my beads.
And we're not having a crack at the coalition for reducing tax. That's a good thing, obviously.
No, again, like same thing with the Israel thing we were just talking about. This is a good policy. Don't care about the political climate as long as companies get taxed less.
That's right, and it's incumbent upon Labor and the crossbenchers to... vote on approve the rest of them so that companies above $50 million... also get the same tax cuts.
Yeah, so if you want to learn more about Australia's tax cut, company tax stuff, a lot of work has been done by Daniel Wild here at the IPA, so go to his profile on the IPA website. You can read the reports he's done. He's done IPA review articles. He's done a heap of work on it, so if you do want to hear more about that, you can go there. I'll move on. So quite linked to the... Australia's like tax rates and stuff is a recent global competitiveness report.
Great segue that was.
Thank you very much. But where's the report from?
The World Economic Forum.
Thank you very much. I forgot to write that part down, but we got there. So World Economic Forum, global competitiveness report came out. US has regained its position at the very top. And you just think that's got to be linked to the reduction in red tape and regulations under Trump. Australia comes in 14th. Not too bad, not too good either. We've got to be aiming higher than that.
14th is a bit kind, I reckon.
Yeah, we're up one spot from the 2017 edition and places 5th in the region and 4 places ahead of New Zealand, which is a KPI.
4 places ahead of New Zealand?
4 places ahead of New Zealand.
That's good.
As long as we're there.
Who's ahead of us in the region?
That's
a bit...
Yeah, I would imagine like Singapore and stuff like that.
Oh, okay.
So places with a lot of low taxes.
You should just know this stuff off the top of your head, mate.
Well, you know, I wasn't prepare, in those meetings. I was in more of the design meetings at the World Economic Forum. So I have a quick bio here for Australia. So Australia's performance shows room for improvement. The functioning of its labour market is notably affected by its rigidity. Australia's innovation capacity is ranked 20 points lower than the best performers in this category. So we're at 69.8, which is pretty nice, but it's not up to the top where people are. The country does well when it comes to research and development, but struggles on the softer dimensions of innovation ecosystem. So anyone that's been following IPA stuff for the last few years wouldn't be too much breaking news for you guys.
Well, Kurt talks about it later.
He does indeed. He talks about the rigidity of the labour market.
I assume he will.
Yes.
Who knows? Given it's in the future.
Yes. Good call. That time machine still... Well, that's another joke that we make in the future. Anyway, show's off the rails. Cancel it. Bin this one. We'll record a new. Welcome to the Young IPA podcast. Anyway, the rigidity of Australia's labour market, the things that we could be doing to increase Australia's innovation system. I mean, that's a lot of stuff that the IPA has been talking about for a while, and this just gives us more to talk about because we need to get up to... Well, I'm saying top 3 should be the aim.
Well, Well, I think we should be aim to be number one, James.
Okay. I was going to say number one, but I thought that would have been reaching too high. But let's go number one. We all agree, number one?
Yeah,
number one. Okay, we're skeptical of the moon landings, and we think Australia should be the most competitive country in the world.
That's a good
start. The list of things that the IPA, this podcast endorses, grows longer with every week.
Definitely not the IPA. The IPA has no view on the moon landing. Let's not
the Young IPA podcast, quite vocal on the subject, however. Yeah.
What we do want to say, though, is that US has reached number one for the first time since the GFC.
Yes.
So it's not like they were number one last year or anything like that.
Yeah, it's not. Yeah, yeah. It's not exactly the Harlem Globetrotters. Cool.
No, it's not like that.
Wouldn't be me if I didn't get a basketball reference in there. Cool. So shall we move on to greenhouse gases?
Yeah, well, you know me, mate. I'm a climate change aficionado. No, I think this is a really interesting story. You will notice that the US under Trump, that great environmental vandal, has reduced their emissions by 2.7% since 2016. And in a very interesting stat, which I didn't realize till this morning when I was reading about this stuff, that is a 67-year low in emissions per capita in America. A 67-year low.
That's pretty big.
That's amazing. So there's that. Now, the reason this is an interesting story is because Trump left the Paris Climate Agreement, which you would all know, which was meant to end the planet. But yet,
yeah, remember when that planet ended?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I do.
Man,
it was traumatic.
That was an afternoon.
And so he gets a lot of negative feedback from that, from his colleagues in other leadership positions.
And when the IPA says Australia should follow suit, we're also climate vandals out of nowhere.
Exactly right. Every single country in the EU is behind their targets to meet the Paris Agreement. Germany, France and Spain in particular are dogging it, as they say in the industry. The German government is likely to push back its 2020 targets to 2030. So I don't understand why they don't cop the same grief that Trump does. And here's a very interesting stat for you, James, which you will enjoy, and Nina. Do you know the country that has the lowest recorded, that has recorded the lowest carbon emissions in their history? The United Kingdom.
Oh,
so it seems
did not see that coming.
Seems to me the best way, and they've done that since. What has England done recently? Oh, Britain done recently?
They left Europe.
So if we want to fight climate change.
Remember when they left Europe?
That's right.
They left a continent.
They left a continent.
Yeah.
What we have to do to fight climate change is disband the EU.
Yeah. I spot the lie.
That's the only conclusion spot the lie that I can possibly come to.
Anytime Australia sends people to Eurovision, we're damaging the planet.
Well, yeah, we are. Unless they click the offset button when they buy their plane tickets. So we should ask why this has happened, why America has reduced their emissions. It's because they have nuclear power and they've increased their use of shale gas, which has been happening pre-Trump. You know, it's been happening for the last few years. And Australia has the opportunity to do both those things, to increase their nuclear power and increase their shale gas power. We are much more heavily regulated than the United States, obviously. So
yeah, and you never know when a tsunami is going to hit outback South Australia.
That's right. That's right.
Because that's when problems can really start arising if you have a nuclear power facility.
Exactly right. Yeah. You have to think about those tectonic plates that are in outback South Australia. But the thing, the obvious irony is the people that support these regulations, which prevent these industries from growing, are the people that say we have to do dramatic things to fight our emissions.
Yeah, and to me, the other thing that I saw in this report, so globally, greenhouse gas emissions are set. Well, this goes to what you were saying about Paris. So global greenhouse gas emissions are set to rise to historic highs by the end of the year, despite 200 countries signing the Paris Climate Accord. So we talk about the EU dogging, and the whole world is dogging the Paris Climate Accord.
except
for us. So when the IPA says, well, do we need to, hurt the Australian economy that much to do to adhere to goals that no one else is going for, mm-hmm. We're the bad guys.
Yep.
I don't get it.
I don't understand either, James.
All right. I was hoping you would.
What was I going to say? No, I can't remember. Oh, no. Hey. I feel like the moment's passed.
What a roller coaster that was. Should we keep that in the show?
I don't know.
The highs and lows.
Yes.
2-1-1.
Me not.
All right. So final thing we're going to talk about here before we get into our interview. So Andrew Bushnell, his new report from the Criminal Justice Project on victims' rights, that got released today. So I think we talked to Andrew a few weeks ago on the show about it, where he's sort of previewing his work, talking about how victims should have the right to appeal criminal trials, which they don't have at the moment, but it can be a way that if a victim of a crime doesn't feel that justice has prevailed, they should be able to say, you know what, that's not good enough, I'm going to take this to a high court. It's a really interesting area, one that doesn't get talked about a whole lot. So you can read the coverage on our website, and you can read his report on the IPA website. So one thing I'll read from Bushnell here. So he says, the public's low confidence in the courts is driven in part by rare and sensational cases in which judges get sentencing wrong. On the whole, the courts do a good job, but these few cases disproportionately affect how the public sees their performance. So what he's saying is, when these outstanding cases do arise, and I'm sure a lot of examples are popping into people's heads as they listen, if the victim of that crime could say, you know what, we're going to a high court, things would be a bit better.
Yeah.
Yep. That's all I've got for that. Cool. Sorry. Bit of event plugging that we have to do here. So the IPA, we're delighted. Delighted. He is one of my favorite writers. Dan Hannan, British MEP. You guys would have heard about him. Hopefully, if you haven't, go to his blog. Best thing in the world. Great follow on Twitter. He is going to be in... Yeah. He's actually that good.
Dan the man.
Sorry. Big on Brexit. He toured Australia a few years ago as well with the IPA. He's coming back. He's going to be talking about what Brexit means for Australia and Britain, what the economic opportunities are. He's going to be in Perth on the 30th of October, and he's going to be in Melbourne on the 31st of October. Hopefully not a Halloween-themed event. I'm still pushing for that, but we'll see. And so you guys can go to the IPA website if you want to get tickets to that. It is unmissable, I'll say that. And he's also going to be doing some stuff for the CIS, so make sure you're going to the CIS website for some of that stuff. And Matthew Lesh, his book, Democracy in a Divided Australia, we talk about that with Kurt. We've talked about it with Matthew on the show previously. Mm-hmm. On Monday night in Canberra, the, what did Morgan call it?
Which draft?
Let's go to the first draft.
The first draft, he called Canberra vile hive of scum and villainy.
Yes. We've got him down to the hive.
Yeah.
And Monday night in Canberra, Tim Wilson, MP, he is going to be launching Matthew's book. So make sure if you're in Canberra and you want to get out of the swamp for just a few hours.
Go to Parliament House.
To Parliament House, ironically.
The eye of the storm.
Cool. And so that is it for the show at the start. So guys, thank you so much for listening and thank you so much for subscribing. We've got new episodes coming out every Friday. And so make sure you're listening to us through iTunes or Podbean or Spotify, any other ones you want, Pocket Casts, any app that you want to listen to podcasts on, that's where we're available on. So make sure you're telling your friends and family about the show. Make sure you're spreading the word so we can get some new listeners. And as I said before, be a real shame. Be a real shame. You'd hate to see it if Pete and I were to log in on Monday and see the exact same number of 5-star reviews left for us on iTunes, because we've got some pretty big guests coming up and... It'd be a real shame.
If it's still 5 million, I'll be livid.
You wouldn't like Pete when he's livid. Cool. Sorry, Nina. If people want to join the IPA and they want to support our work, maybe they'll hear about our interviews with Kurt and Morgan and want to support the work that we do, where can people go if they want to become a member, and where can people go if they want to donate?
Well, just visit our website, theipa.org.au, and click donate button if you want to donate. Click join button if you like to become a member. And starting as low as $22 per year, you become one of the loudest voices of freedom in Australia.
Very cool. Let's go to those interviews now. Okay, we now welcome back onto the show one of the very good friends of the podcast.
That's not what you said last week.
No, we said foe. So one of the good foes and friends, a bit of a frenemy relationship. Frenemy. So Morgan Berg, research fellow here at the IPA, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, boys.
So let's get into it. So we had a lot of religious freedom issues around the world come up in the last few weeks, and we had a pretty chock-a-block full show last week, so we couldn't get you in to talk us through it. So I think we'll actually, you know what, we'll start with the Spectator Australia, because your article last week was pretty cool, talking about the Reds on the red carpet. Mm-hmm. Now, we were discussing it on the show, and we've decided that we're skeptical of the moon landing. So first off, did the moon landings happen in your view?
I think they did.
Okay, well.
Sorry to...
What a traitor.
Absolute foe of the show.
I'm a boring pedestrian orthodox.
Just accept what the man tells you.
Yeah, you know.
Do your own research, dogs, for once in your life.
Right. I'm just a... I blindly accept what my what the elite tells me.
We've always said that about you. All right, so let's talk about it, because it was a really interesting article, still available on the IPA website, and it's talking about how American filmmakers are now gearing their films to appeal to the Chinese censors so that they can get into the very luxurious Chinese market.
Yeah.
And one of the ones you brought up, and the reason we got skeptical about the moon landings, was First Man, where they didn't even film a scene where the US flag is planted on the moon.
Yeah.
So do you want to talk about that decision?
I think it's just so typical of where Hollywood's at now. Once upon a time, you know, decades ago, Hollywood was, you know, a proud sort of exhibition of the heroism and the virtues of Western civilization, the Anglo-American sphere of the world. And that's all sort of fallen away now to the point that they're not even ashamed of the West, but they're actively accommodating, you know, the tyrannical regimes in China and other and elsewhere. And like you said, it's you know, they think that's where the money is. You know, there's a lot of people there, and they think, we'll play along. We'll censor our product. And it happens again and again. And it's pretty sad. It's a big problem.
So give us a few examples. So obviously, you know, the people probably understand the logic of this, but give us some specific examples of where this has happened.
It's all happened in sort of the last 10 years predominantly. They did a remake of the Red Dawn movie, which, you know, that was an 80s movie which featured a Soviet-Cuban invasion of the American mainland. And that was remade and updated, and it was originally going to feature a Chinese invasion force.
Just to explain the plotline of the film, but people haven't seen it. So it's like overnight in the original Soviet-Cuban, they land and it's up to local American teenagers to fight back. Destroy the invasion.
It's just a classic sort of American 80s movie. And that was remade, and it was originally planned to. Who's the biggest sort of red foe in the world?
Canada.
Not yet. It's the Chinese, and then of course they did that, and then they, you know, like the Quislings, they tend to be in Hollywood. They turned them into the North Koreans, which is inexplicable. I mean, can you really? Of course, the movie failed because it's sort of there's a divorce from reality.
Yep.
There's a divorce from reality in local teenagers stopping an international invasion.
You can only bend the bar so far before it snaps. You know?
For North Korea to launch an attack on mainland USA right now,
that'd
create a few headlines.
That's not so. I was going to say, but what's the answer to this, Morgan? Because, you know, they're within their rights to access their market. They're trying to turn a dime here. I can't in my own mind work out what they should do about still getting to the Chinese markets but not getting through the censors. Or is it just something we need to raise awareness of?
It's a question of awareness and honesty and transparency. But it's also a point of, I think when Hollywood does this, when they, you know, they sacrifice their own sort of artistic integrity for the censors. Of a foreign country.
There's something wrong.
People don't
it.
Like it. Yeah. And I think it's reflected. I think less people are bothering going to the movies. Mm. I think, look at The First Man. I mean, I'm conflating China with all the problems of Hollywood, but First Man, just as a...
Conflate away, mate.
As a illustration of that cowardice now. It hasn't made an impact at all. You know, it sort of went under the charts, you know, third place in the box office, and it's sort of dropping away. And no one cares. And I think that's just sort of the perfect example of it. But a movie like Venom, say, which is just a, you know, ridiculous action movie, you know, everyone loves it. Mm-hmm. It's fun. It's escapism. It's escapism. It's not too hard to understand. You just got to, you know, stick to your guns and sort of try to serve people.
Because Hollywood
used to
be...
Serve the consumer.
Hollywood used to be overtly patriotic, didn't it?
Well, that's right. I mean, it was...
In
the 50s. They had the production code, which I think is a... I actually miss it. But but this was self-regulation by the industry to sort of... leave out certain things and sort of broadcast the virtues of, middle-class America.
Well, my other point with that...
The good guy always wins.
Yeah.
The good guys are always, you know, virtuous and heroic. And, you know, America are the good guys. You know, it's like that sort of thing.
Yeah, I get very doe-eyed optimism talking about the influence of, you know, art and culture and that sort of stuff. But you just think, like, in the late 80s when music started to get into Eastern Europe, you had just waves of teenagers going, hang on, that's so much cooler than what we have right now.
Even like Chuck Norris movies and stuff. Like people in Eastern Europe were watching that.
Yeah, that's a really cool documentary.
Awesome.
Yeah, Chuck Norris movies started again in Eastern Europe and people like, I love America. Think, like, if Americans were like, okay, we're just going to make the movies we want to make, there's a lot of Chinese teenagers who would go, hang on, there's some really cool things
out
there.
That's 100% correct. When we interviewed Eun-hee Park, the North Korean defector, on this very show, she literally said the thing that started to attract her about the West was smuggled DVDs of American movies.
Yeah, it can be really powerful.
Yeah, exactly right. Soft power. So you have to, and that is soft power, that's right. And you have to, you know, there's a lot of influence in that, and you have to, you know, you want to make sure that the sort of influence you're spreading is, you know, is grounded in good values. It's, you know, you can't be spreading sort of, so much entertainment now is just terrible people.
Morgan's getting sad.
I can't stand film and television nowadays because all the protagonists, quote unquote, are terrible people. Why would I care?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of anti-heroes. Like, that's since Breaking Bad got famous, it's like, oh, this, you know, your hero needs to also be capable of terrible evil. It's kind of tough. Really? It's like, it's stuff that really applies to career-long writers because they're fascinating characters to write and follow. But for people who's like, look, I've been welding for 8 hours. I just want to put my feet up.
That's it. Well, that's right. The thing is, though, those sorts of stories, it's like those can be really interesting when they get it right. But I just don't feel good.
No. Hamlet Breaking Bad can be an exhausting watch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right.
Hamlet was flawed.
He was. And then ultimately, those flaws got to him.
Yeah.
Cool. So
Shakespeare was a tool of the Chinese.
There's our podcast quote for next week. Hey, now, so let's talk about some of the religious freedom stuff that's been going on around the world. And the big one that we saw, so we're going international with this one, is in the UK.
Yep.
They've had their own can you make a cake for a gay wedding case get heard. Do you want to talk about that case?
So this is the Ashes bakery case, this all stems back from 2014, when a customer asked a baker to bake a cake and to decorate the cake, which had a message of support gay marriage or something along those lines, and that is turned into this epic legal saga, which has finally been determined by the Supreme Court of the UK, which has said that it's not sexual orientation discrimination because they were being asked to publish a message on their cake, which was in support of gay marriage. And they said they would have objected to doing that regardless of who the customer was. And I think, you know, we've been, anyone that's observed this case has been saying that for years and years. I think it's an indictment on these discrimination laws that it, you know, it's taken 4 or 5 years to get to the point where it's like, yeah, that's being asked to publish a message.
Yeah, exactly.
And objecting to it isn't discrimination.
Yeah, 4 or 5 years and like 3 or 4 courts or so. Constantly
it's just
getting
appealed and appealed. Yeah,
particularly in Northern Ireland where people must like refuse to be involved in certain wedding ceremonies all the time. Do you know what I mean?
Well, like, even like interdenominational.
Yeah, that's what I was saying.
You know, I mean, that would be a problem as much as a Protestant being asked to bake a Catholic cake. I don't know if those problems are as pronounced anymore, but
I can imagine that.
But it's the same
simmering tensions.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
I'm no legal expert, Morgan, which might surprise you.
Can't even say the word expert.
Yes, that's how far away I am. But one of the things that struck me about this was in one of the build-up courts, getting to the Supreme Court, like the District Court or something, I'm not sure what it's called, the judge said that upheld the initial finding because they said that to support gay marriage was a part of being gay, basically.
Which
is that like completely unprecedented?
That's
extraordinary to me.
At that point, I believe it was at that point unprecedented. I think that sort of opinion has been used in American courts.
It's amazing.
It's extraordinary.
All these people must think the same way.
They're just, it's a hive mind.
Yeah.
They're NPCs.
Google it.
Yeah. But it's extraordinary, and it's, I think that's bigoted, to be honest.
Yeah.
To assume that because you have some sort of characteristic, you must believe this. Yeah.
That political opinion.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So I'm glad that that's, I think maybe there's been a bit of pushback against that idea in recent times, and I really hope so, and I hope that doesn't get applied in Australia.
Cool. So we'll move. So in Australia, there's the whole debate about religious discrimination, and the proposals from the Ruddock Review, they got leaked out by the Sydney Morning Herald. Still a ways to go before we just like see what the government's going to do with those and what effects that's going to take. So at the moment, it's all baseless speculation. But one thing I do want to ask is, if Australia were to have its own gay wedding cake case tomorrow or something like that, what do you reckon with existing legal framework, or maybe under the frameworks of what you saw in that Ruddock Review, what would be the determination from a judge, do you reckon? Like, where would Australia stand on the gay wedding cake issue?
It's tough to say. I think it's...
Speculate wildly.
I'll speculate wildly. It's a question of what state or territory this would happen in. For instance, I'd say in Tasmania, where the threshold for offensive or insulting conduct is so low, you could easily see the same sort of saga happen in Tasmania. But in other jurisdictions where the laws aren't so low, I think, and it's all a question of, how would a judge decide it? And it's always really tricky to sort of make those predictions.
Right.
But if you had a sympathetic judge, in most jurisdictions, the laws are there to be applied how a judge best sees fit. That's why you have to take that element out of consideration and get rid of the laws to ensure that an Ashes case didn't happen here.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But I think we're going to be pretty far away from that one for a while. So we'll move on to the final, highbrow area. We've got a few fun ones at the end here.
Which fits in with what Morgan just said.
Yes, exactly. So the Kavanaugh stuff, it's wrapping up in the US. It's been nominated. And Pete and I made the decision we weren't really going to talk about Kavanaugh while the case was going on, because it just, we don't know what Kavanaugh got up to in college in the 80s. Pete and I weren't there. But there was a whole lot of coverage out there.
You got to do your work and get back there. And
yeah. Well, the time machine is on the way. But
speaking of 80s movies, yeah. They're optimistic.
Andy is tight with the budget on that one. So we'll talk about, because the angle to me that was interesting is why the US Supreme Court is becoming such a political issue in itself. And you linked us to an article a few weeks ago, and I think we put it in Hay, talking about how most of the big wins of progressive movements in the US weren't decided at the ballot box, but were decided at the Supreme Court. And so that's when, the Supreme Court gets a lot of conservatives onto it. That's when progressives can really start panicking.
Most of the big sort of progressive wins in America, at least in the last 50 years, have all been won. They don't have the Democratic the sort of popular support for them, but they get it through on the judiciary, because winning over 9 people is easier than winning over 300 million.
Yes.
That's why they fight so hard. But the other side of that is, it's really good to see that the conservatives in America have, I think they're fully aware of this now, and it's been brought home to them, like how much of a huge battle, an important battle it is to ensure that you have good, principled people on the court to take this power away from activist, progressive judges.
Yeah, but is that a good thing that the Supreme Court can be a political issue? Like, surely you'd think of it as, like, these are just the 9 most expert people in law to decide, for the separation of powers, but like now that it's a political football as akin to just any congressional race, is that like a good thing for American democracy?
It's a nice idea, but the idea of having, you know, the 9 best judges, unfortunately you have half of the political spectrum which thinks that the 9 best judges are the 9 best lawmakers or the 9 best judges who will update the Constitution. And of course, you know, when you have those appointments made, which are, I think, you know, at their core are political considerations of, you know, this judge believes in this.
So Republican presidents will appoint Republican leaning.
Well,
I
think that, the honest truth is that it is by its nature a political institution, and it's been politicized. I'd say it's been politicized by the left, and this goes back to at least as far back as Roosevelt,
right.
who threatened to, you know, double the size of the court to ensure that his laws got through, and they buckled and sort of acquiesced to him, and it's been a very radical sort of example of how the court can be politicized.
If Trump made that speech today, that's like front page for a month.
Don't tell him that that's an option.
I think Morgan would want to tell him that's an option. Yeah.
the response from Republicans isn't to appoint partisans, isn't, or, you know, political hacks or anything. It's, you find the principles of good judicial interpretation, constitutional practice, which is, you interpret the Constitution according to how it was written and for the intentions that it was written, and then you appoint people who also believe in that principle.
Right.
And that they might come from any political persuasion. I think, like, I would say that the Alan Dershowitz, who is a lifelong Democrat, would be a worthy choice on the Supreme Court.
Wasn't one of Bush's appointees the guy that was the swing vote which upheld Obamacare?
So your partisan Republican choices can backfire on you just like that.
You got
to go by principle. You got to go by those bedrock principles. Yeah.
Right, because like my final one with this, one thing I did read when I was, you know, following the Kavanaugh case was that Scalia, who, you know, firebrand, like conservative kind of guy, didn't have a single vote against him when he went up, but Kavanaugh, you know, pretty much split the house. And I know Kavanaugh, there was, you know, the sexual assault things would have done a fair bit of that, but I found it weird that not a single person was against the firebrand conservative back in the 80s or whenever Scalia went up, but his replacement was so divisive. Is that, like, is it increasingly political now, or what do you reckon?
I think so. I think all of the problems that we're seeing now started in the 80s. And of course, up until, you know, I'd say up until Reagan, really, the Republican appointments and the Democrat appointments were fairly similar. And it was only when Reagan started appointing conservative judges, that's when there was a lot of sort of organized Democrat opposition, because before then, you know, most nominees were just, they were waved through, you know, they were, you know, the process happened and they went through, and it was fairly
just convention.
It was fairly conventional. But then, of course, you know, when, you know, people from the right started being appointed, then, you know, you had the, you know, Robert Bork was the first example, and he was done, and that was in the mid 80s. But then, of course, Scalia came afterwards, but he was waved through, so it was not happening as much then, of course. But now I think you're just going to find now that, you know, the more picks that Trump gets, the more opposition he'll get. I think it'll just be over and over again.
Absolutely.
It's definitely a function of polarisation right now.
Yeah.
As well.
Yeah. I think we'll move on to some fun ones now.
That wasn't fun.
That was fun, but some funny ones. So, Morgan, big week for you in that Australia has some members of the royal family running around, especially in our city. Are they here? Where are they?
They were here yesterday. I don't know where they are today.
Right.
They haven't told me yet, so.
You're not on the media.
Waiting for the text.
Yeah, so Morgan, the IPA's resident, royal family backer, I think. Big fan of the royal family.
Did not familiar with the word monikers.
Yeah, oh, that's it. I was like, there's got to be a word for this somewhere. Just in my arsenal of English language.
I was like, why does he just say that? Anyway.
Thanks for just chiming in to help me out there. String me out. The IPA's resident monarchist. Bella has, she's given up the title ever since she said that being retweeted by Jordan Peterson was a bigger career highlight than getting read by the Queen.
Even though she's got aristocratic relations.
Yeah, so Morgan, now undisputed monarchist of the IPA. How are you feeling about the royals in Australia?
Oh, look, it's always great when the royal family visits because it's always coincides, strangely enough, with an uptick in monarchist sentiment. I think people just people enjoy it. People, you know, there is a certain magic of monarchy. Mm.
Every time a royal gets pregnant, the Republican movement is set back 5 years.
I think that's right. So, you know, just keep cranking them out. Of course, I mean no disrespect at all. But I think it's a great thing. And I hope there's more visits and more babies.
Very good. All right. And one last thing I'm going to ask is the Deep Demons Cricket Club, something very near and dear to Pete and Morgan's heart.
Mm.
I like that you're interested in it. I'm not interested in myself, but I appreciate the interest that you guys
have.
You
will be. You'll be down in fine league soon enough.
Absolutely not.
Sorry, you go.
No, I was just going to say, talk to me about the upcoming season, boys. What are we thinking?
Well, we need Morgan.
Yeah, it's a bit like Schrodinger's cat at the moment. We haven't opened the box to see whether I'm playing or not.
Yeah. We've got Daniel Wall. We've got.
I thought Melissa. That was going to get a lot darker when you compare yourself to Schrodinger's cat.
But we do need Morgan Begwit. A little bit tight for numbers, as we perennially are. And we need Morgan. His real leadership down there. They love him. They love him. He's actually, believe it or not, the Dina's resident monarchist.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's like the one thing about Morgan. Loves the Queen. Anyway,
translates everywhere I go, yeah.
The other thing is Daniel Wilde has been promoted to the seconds on the back of making 50 last week. So
that's a Q&A clap.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep, Tony Jones is on board. And Morgan, so the threes need Morgan for that, you know, leadership.
Oh.
If Dan's in the twos, then I want to be in the twos. That's all I've got to say.
Okay. Well, we'll see what we can do.
Make your 50, Morgs. All right. Morgan, thank you so much for joining us.
What, I have to earn it? No.
Sorry, man. So, Morgan, your article on Reds on the Red Carpet is available at the IPA website from the Spectator Australia. Anything else to promote here? No, I think we're just talking about wider issues. Morgan, thank you so much for having us, for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having us, Morgan.
This is Morgan's world. We're just living in it. Okay, we now welcome onto the show for the first time, very exciting, Kurt Wallace, research fellow here at the IPA, newly minted research fellow, I should add. Kurt, welcome.
Thanks, guys. Great to be here.
Now, Kurt is short for Kurtley, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
I'm obsessed by that. I didn't realise that till Kurt started at the IPA, that was actually how that works, but it is.
Okay, well, there we go. So
he's already teaching me.
It's good. It's a process. All right, so Kurt, very new here to the IPA. I think this is week number 2 or 3?
Yeah, week 2.
Week 2. So tell us what you're going to be working on when you're working here at the IPA.
Yeah, so I'm going to be working on the Dignity of Work project here at the IPA. So that's really looking at the moral case for work, the importance that work has in individuals' lives, and also just looking at sort of the barriers to work, the governmental barriers to that and industrial relations and how we can sort of advocate for a system where people are more easily employed and a more flexible system to promote a really important part of human flourishing.
That's fantastic. We do talk a lot about that kind of stuff on the podcast. And of course, we live that every day with our dignified work, James. But also,
we are the model citizens for us to aspire to be.
When you think of dignity, you think of me and James. But I wanted to ask, because I know you're from down Warrnambool way, is that right?
Yeah, so my family has a dairy farm near Warrnambool, so in Brucknell, which is just out of Timboon. So not sure if any of our listeners know that area, but yeah, that's where my family have a farm.
That's right. So not everyone at the IPA is, inner city, cosmopolitan, blah, 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 blah. You're not getting out of here, James.
Yes, inners, to use the term from Revelation's book.
Yeah. Definitely an outer.
Yeah.
So
did you take the quiz?
Yeah, I took the quiz. Oh, I got an outer. So
first outer on the show, I think. Okay. Pete and I were betweeners.
Yeah. James Patterson was
betweener. Yep.
Lesh was an inner.
Yep. We need to start polling all of our guests. How they go. Anyway, so let's talk about that. So Dignity Work Project, Gideon Rosner has been on the show a bunch of times, was also working in that field. Now he's moved on to other areas of the IPA. So it's a lot of talk about issues like minimum wage and industrial relations. So are there any sort of specific policies that you're going to be looking at and analysing or thinking about?
Yeah, so I think like the big ones, like as you said, like minimum wage, also like penalty rates, like the dismissal laws, those things, like barriers to employment. So anything that hinders employment or stops businesses from being able to employ people or people with different skill sets being employed. Yeah, those sort of things I'll be looking at. So, yeah.
So you're obviously a highly sought after young man. You know, you've got the world at your feet. Why the IPA? What was it about this organisation that made you want to work here? How old are you, Kurt, by the way?
I'm 26.
26, okay.
Yeah. Oh, well, I've been a member of the IPA for a few years now, mm-hmm. So followed the work. A fan of the podcast. So,
oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow, well,
I paid him to say that, but
I've been following the work of the IPA for a number of years. I'm really impressed with the things that the IPA advocates. So freedom of economic freedom and individual freedom, particularly in areas of economics and free speech as well. I've been impressed with the IPA's work and jumped at the opportunity to come work here. So and we're very pleased to be here.
And we're delighted you're here. So I have one more thing I'm going to ask about the minimum wage.
Now. Oh, yeah, sorry.
It's all good.
Because there was stuff that came out today about the...
There might have been, but this is my pre-prepared question. Okay, I just want to say to Kurt, so when you're talking about the minimum wage, one thing I do want to let you know is that when you advocate for policies that secure employment for people, give people a lot of their first shot of business, or maybe they're coming out of prison maybe, and it's like they're getting back into the community. Nina. I just want you to know that when you're advocating for these policies that get people into jobs, you're actually the bad guy. Mm. So just be aware of that.
Yeah,
be aware that like advocating for people that really need help makes you the bad guy.
You're exploiting them, Kurt.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's a bit of a thing to get past with a lot of people when talking about these sorts of things. Like, it doesn't sound good to say that you want more flexible firing laws, but that's really just to incentivize hiring. So, yeah, if it's really difficult to fire somebody, that's... some people might
don't
think
we know it.
Some people might don't think that's a good thing, but... It actually makes.
Dave just like looked at each other and yeah. Like, yeah,
that's
sorry.
Why you guys
sorry,
are still Kurt. Here. So, no. So it actually makes it really difficult for employers if they know that they're taking a huge risk in employing people, because if it doesn't work out, then they potentially have to go through the rigmarole and the huge costs of firing the person. So, yeah, making things more flexible in that regard, is good for employment. It's good for everybody. So. Yeah, but it is a thing where a lot of people can't get past. Like, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So one other thing I want to ask. So when you toured around the IPA, you actually knew a fair few people already. Do you want to explain how you got to meet a lot of the people who already work at the IPA?
Yeah, so I've met a couple of people at previous like RPA member events and that sort of thing. But mm-hmm. A few months ago, I was at one of your... house parties.
My vaunted house parties.
One of those cesspit of humanities that Bolt holds periodically at the back of his dank share house. Yeah.
If you've ever read The Great Gatsby, it's the inverse of what's going on there.
Yeah.
Just anything they write, you just flip it and you're like, all right, that's what's going on here. But like, you're really good friends with one of my housemates.
Yeah, so yeah, friends with one of your housemates. I went to uni with him, so yeah, that's where I... got invited to the party and
he was
still wanted to work here.
Maybe
you met Pete.
I actually don't remember meeting.
No, I'm not sure I met you, but that's probably why I was still keen.
So. That'd be right.
All right, cool. So Kurt, we're going to be looking out for your work on Dignity of Work and on industrial relations and all that stuff. Thank you so much for joining us on the show. We'll talk to you when you got a report out.
Great, thanks guys.
Thanks Kurt.
Okay, thank you to Morgan and Kurt for those interviews. Really interesting stuff.
Big Kurtly.
So let's fly through some other stories this week. And I think we'll start with you know, not the funniest one in the world, but I think it's pretty interesting. Pete, you saw something about Sears.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, we're doing that one. Okay, yeah, Sears. So this is, yeah, this is a heartwarming story.
Yeah.
So Sears is a department store in the United States, as you would know, that's actually about to close down. And there's this piece, I think, in Washington Post during the week about how Sears, during the Jim Crow era in Southern America, actually was a way for African-Americans to circumvent racist segregation laws and arrangements and things like that. So obviously, a lot of African-Americans were banned from going to certain stores. And if they were going to certain stores, they were only allowed to go to certain parts of those stores, or they were given substandard products. Do you know what I mean? So if it's a food product, they would give them the worst flour or whatever it was, right? So one way they got around this, though, was Sears had a catalogue thing, like sort of, I don't know if they invented the catalogue thing, but they were maybe the first one to make it go that massive, where African-Americans were able to buy good stuff through mail order catalogues and get around that stuff. I've got a quote from an African-American woman at that time, Mamie Fields, who was born in segregated South Carolina in 1888, wrote in her memoir, "Some of them did think colored people oughtn't to have a certain nice thing, even if they had enough money to buy it. Our people used to send off for certain items with the catalogue. That way, too, the crackers wouldn't know what you had in your house." So this isn't just stuff, right? It's not just like a toaster and stuff like that. I don't think a toaster existed back then, but you understand what I'm saying. This is like a dignity thing. Do you know what I mean? And, you know, there's a whole argument for how free markets undermine racism. There's a whole lot of studies out there that show that trading free economics between people increases tolerance and decreases conflict between groups. And this was a heartwarming story about the free market fighting racism.
Yeah, it was such a cool story. I just love when people use the market to just overcome all these other things that usually would get in the way.
Get around the obstacles set up by this evil stuff.
Yeah, so that article is from the Washington Post. So the headline was "Sears' Radical Past, How Mail Order Catalogs Subverted the Racial Hierarchy of Jim Crow." Such a fascinating story. So make sure you guys go and read that. It was a really cool thing. Not the funniest thing. We usually reserve the end of the show for the funny stuff. But, you know, that was just a really cool thing we wanted to share with our listeners.
Can also be nice stuff.
Can also be nice stuff.
At the second half of the show.
This is a funny thing. So Elizabeth Warren had herself a week and a half. So if you guys don't know who she is a Democratic. She will probably one day run for president for the Democrats. Very far left wing.
Senator.
For Massachusetts. So, you know, that's as left wing as you get. Democratic senator for Massachusetts is... that's swamp territory. Anyway, it is. Anyway, so one thing that Elizabeth Warren is famous for, she identifies as a Native American, and she's used, she's put that on a lot of things. I think, so part of it was she listed herself as she's considered a minority hire. The University of Pennsylvania listed her as a minority faculty member. She was touted after her hire at Harvard Law School as the school's first woman of color. A lot of stuff like that. And Trump started to talk, there was a lot of questions about how Native American was she really? And she also added her traditional Native American recipe to a cookbook once. And Trump got himself, you know, as he always does, Elizabeth Warren got on the sites, he started calling her Pocahontas and challenged her to take a DNA test. She did. The results are in. Elizabeth Warren is roughly 1/64th to 1/1024th. Native American.
So not that much.
Not that much.
So that's 6 to 10 generations
ago.
Ago between
there was one Native American person.
Yep.
In her lineage. So, it's a rough look. It's a rough look for her.
What was that stat you showed me about the average amount of Native American in white Americans?
This makes her, on average, this makes her less. She has less Native American ancestry than the average white American.
That true?
Yes.
Wow.
It's a bad look.
It's not
a good look.
Why isn't weaponizing weaponizing this kind of stuff deemed as bad as other forms of, using other people's bad experiences and discrimination to further your career is pretty bad.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. But because she's left wing, it was like one day of, you know, jokes and memes, and then the media were like, okay, but we still like her. So she's got less Native American ancestry than the average American.
Yeah.
Trump has to take one. If Trump is more Native American than Elizabeth Warren, that would be amazing.
But aren't his parents from Germany or something?
Yeah, but you got to try. You don't have to release it, but you got to try.
Maybe he has.
You got to be in it to win it. So it's a fun thing because there's now all these things about reanalyzing her traditional Native American recipe that she added to the cookbook and Harvard Law School touting her as the first woman of color that the school had. So, not a good look anymore. But like, again, it's classic identity politics, and yeah, the real issue is, yeah, the real issue is, like, it's funny because, you know, this blew up in her face and that's funny, but the fact is she has pretty bad policies, especially on economic grounds, and I'm glad this makes her less likely to become president.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I don't, like, if they're trying to find someone who's going to beat Trump next time around,
it ain't hurt.
Let's choose an academic who weaponizes a minority.
And is a senator from Massachusetts.
Yeah. Like, it doesn't feel like you've learned from your mistakes.
No,
but,
not at all.
The thing is, like, it doesn't matter how much Native American is. I mean, I'm just repeating what you said, but... Yeah.
Oh, please. But I like hearing my own thoughts
and
back.
And she's like, oh...
Some of them, anyway.
She supported handouts to big corporates after the GFC, but she also thinks that there should be a public stakeholder on every board of big corporations in America. So
riddle me that one, people.
Her economics policies are bad and schizophrenic.
Absolutely. So let's move on to another story.
All right. So another story that we want to talk about is Teen Vogue. Speaking of economics, these guys are at least consistent. But they're bad. Teen Vogue, for some reason this week, tweeted out an article.
Traditionally a fashion magazine, by the way.
Yeah.
Like Vogue and then Teen Vogue. So, you know, pop culture, fashion tips and stuff like that.
That's good background because I don't know much about fashion, as you would know. But they tweeted out this week.
I'm wearing shorts.
An article.
So just to let people know where the fashion
James is. James has been outrageously controversial when wearing shorts on a Friday. Tweeted out this article in April, from April this year. I don't know why they tweeted it out this week, but they did. It says, can't end poverty without ending capitalism, and then a link to an article about that by Kim Kelly. It's called What Capitalism Is and How It Affects People. They tweeted, can't end poverty without ending capitalism. If you got rid of the ending in that tweet, it would be 100% correct. So they're almost there. But unfortunately, this is just an article bagging capitalism, which completely doesn't understand what capitalism is and how that's really bad to teach young people that. My favourite quote, capitalism is by nature exploitative and leads to a brutally divided society that tramples the working class in favour of fattening the rich's wallets. For an example, in recent history, the Occupy Wall Street movement began as an anti-capitalist process against the 1% and asked why they are allowed to grow fat and happy whilst 20% of all American children live in poverty.
That's just fat shaming.
That is fat shaming.
That's fat shaming rich people.
That is fat shaming rich
people.
Come
on, Teen Vogue. You're a fashion magazine. You've got to be body positive.
Also, that 20%... Yeah, that's true, actually.
Yeah.
That 20% of all Americans living in poverty is not correct. It's like 3%. And also, the 1% thing with Occupy Wall Street is like most Occupy Wall Street protesters are in the top 1% of global income earners.
Absolutely.
Yep.
I just like the first sentence of the article really sets a tone. Capitalism is defined as an economic system in which a country's trade, industry, and profits are controlled by private companies instead of the people whose time and labor power those companies.
What?
So you know where we're coming from here.
So we went through a few articles that this person's written. They wrote last month, Everything You Need to Know About Anarchism.
Ooh.
A couple of weeks ago, Unsung Heroes of Latin Farmworkers' Labor Movement from Maria Moreno to Fast Food Boycotters. That sounds like a great read.
How many times do you reckon this writer's pitched articles to other websites? Just like, I can't keep writing for Teen Vogue.
Yeah.
Like, I'm sharing the cubicle with the 6 makeup tips you need for summer. Like, I need out.
Yeah, this is not my...
I'm a serious journalist.
Why can't they get a job with Socialist Weekly or something? Anyway, but also I noticed on the Teen Vogue website while I was there... headline from today, Kanye West is what internalized racism and misogyny looks like.
Ooh.
Is that just not completely racist?
It's
like Kanye
racist.
Doesn't know his own mind?
Yeah, yeah. I think Kanye West just looks like Kanye West to me.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So I got a bit of a problem down there.
Yeah, so Teen Vogue, subscribe now. Anyway, move on to another one. Okay, new article from ABC Online. New South Wales Labour MLC Shawquet Mosselmain says his decision to link Twitter followers to a story on the website of a former Ku Klux Klan leader was a bad mistake.
Yeah, it sounds like
I'd imagine so. he retweeted an article talking about... So we talked in the show about earlier about moving the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. Now, Bob Carr, former foreign minister, was not too happy with that. And David Duke, former grand wizard of the Ku Klux Klan, made a blog post talking about Bob Carr's comments. And then, what's his name again? Shawquet Mosselmain retweeted that. Now, yeah, obviously this was a terrible mistake by, like, you know, I don't know how that happens.
Wow.
But
the person in charge of his Twitter feed.
Yeah, the person in charge of his Twitter feed. And then they realize, hang on, what's that, daviddukes.com? Isn't that guy a bit of a weirdo? And they deleted that. David Duke is, like, is that bad? If you don't know who David Duke is, like Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan, you like, and not one of those like, you know, the former Ku Klux Klan wizard who realized the error of his ways and is now like teaching tolerance. Like he's like, yeah, they're still like he's still definitely on the email subscribers.
Yeah.
He still gets their newsletters for sure. You can't retweet David Duke under any circumstance.
Bit of a clanger, I'd say.
It's a massive clanger.
And we're obviously not suggesting that he, you know, agrees with this guy.
No. definitely not. I want that on record.
Yeah. But my thing is, I imagine if this was a conservative politician, I think there would have been a bit more news about it.
They would resign immediately. They would have to. Now, this leads me to the question. So David Duke, really bad guy. Do not endorse him in any way.
Yep.
At all.
Yep.
What political issue or what issue could come up that would fire you up so much that you didn't realize that you're retweeting David Duke?
Well, there's a question.
That's something I was thinking about.
I'm gonna go vertical fiscal imbalance.
It's a bloody rort.
It's an outrage.
So you tweet that, then realize David Duke can take it down, but you'd be in such a state at your outrage at this issue. I was just gonna say
most racists are communists as well. So
Coldplay's first three albums are better than their other works. Like, that's a debate. I think Coldplay's first three albums are that good.
Yeah, okay.
So that's one where I would just see that and retweet and then go, oh, hang on, it's David Duke. I'm going to take that down.
Yeah.
David Duke, bad guy. Okay, we can cut this. We can cut this. But I do want to say this. Okay. We can cut it. The term Grand Wizard.
Yeah, okay.
It's got to be the least intimidating term ever made. Like, Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan.
It's a bit...
I could take a Grand Wizard on in a fight. Like, if you told me, like, dude, that guy's a Grand Wizard, I'm not going back and down.
Wearing a bedsheet.
Exactly.
I think back in the day, maybe back in the days when, like, you know, 70% of American governors were in the KKK, it might have been a bit more intimidating. Perhaps not
No,
now.
But, like, the word wizard.
Grand Wizard. It's like, not even, like... It's like Dumbledore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wizards are, like, helpful.
Well,
you want to go Grand Warlock, at least. Anyway, that's my thought.
Yeah, well, that's fair enough. Don't cut that.
Go back to the books. Cool. I've got one more, I think.
Yeah, no, this is you.
Okay,
this
cool.
is right in your wheelhouse.
Yes.
Combined your two great loves.
One of my great loves and one of my great hates. I want that on the record. Anyway, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, speaking of Twitter.
That was fantastically pronounced.
Thank you very much.
Do it again.
Mahmoud Ahmadinejad.
Yeah, no,
so, President of Iran.
Ex-president.
Ex-president of Iran. Not a great guy. I think we can all be on board with that one. Not a great guy. So he's also on Twitter.
Yep.
And he's been tweeting a lot. And one topic that seems to be very near and dear to his heart, strangely enough, is US sports.
Yeah.
He tweeted, the NFL season starts today. I can't believe Colin Kaepernick's not on a team. Now, maybe that's a political issue. But I also like this one. With a hard work ethic, inshallah, the University of Michigan will return to its glory days.
Yeah. Well, you know. Osama bin Laden was a big Arsenal fan.
I didn't know that. So, you know, like University of Michigan college football team, like he's replying to the coach. Interesting.
Well, seeing it, there'd be a lot of people who retweet that without sort of doing their homework.
Yeah,
see what the last story really. Yeah. How good's this guy?
Hey, no, yeah, we will. No. Under Coach Jim Harbaugh. And then also he weighed in on Serena Williams and someone tweeted back at him. And I just want to read this one out. And so he tweeted out, why is the French Open disrespecting Serena Williams? Unfortunately, some people in all countries, including my country, haven't realized the true meaning of freedom. That's an amazing tweet right there.
That is.
That's.
Hang on, what?
Put that in a museum. So anyway, some... Sorry,
I just accidentally smashed my microphone with my hand.
Don't do that. Nevsun Mengu then tweeted back, dude, you're forcing hijab on Iranian women, making them wear long mantos in 40 degrees heat. Some women don't want to cover themselves. Your regime forces an Islamic uniform on them. You are not the defender of freedoms.
I was going to say that.
And then Ahmadinejad tweets back, I never forced anyone to do such a thing. Hashtag dude. I mean, that's just funny. So it is a fascinating time for US sports at the moment. We've had Dennis Rodman save the North Korea. We've had him find peace. We've got Mahmoud Ahmadinejad using college football.
Mm-hmm.
So hopefully, like, we can get a few stars over there into Iran to promote freedom. So what I want to do? What's a country that also needs a lot more freedom?
North Korea.
No, North Korea's already been sold by Dennis Rodman.
Saudi Arabia.
Saudi Arabia. What we do? We send over a DVD of the AFL Grand Final and Warwick Kappa. And we just let the world, we just let what happens unfold.
Yeah, I mean,
there'd be peace in days.
Warwick is.
If Dennis Rodman can solve North Korea, Warwick Kappa would have it'd be the most free country in the world.
Yeah.
With Warwick Kappa's help.
He lives very freely, Warwick. So,
by the way, to execute that joke, I had to go to Warwick Kappa's Wikipedia page.
Okay.
No Wikipedia page has ever more obviously been written by that person.
Really?
I remember like we talked about that person at the EU that wrote their own Wikipedia page and got sanctioned for it.
Yeah, yeah.
Warwick Kappa would be sweating bullets when that decision got handed down. There is a lot of stuff that only Warwick Kappa would know.
What did you go to his...
Well, I wanted to say, because like...
Just to check if he was alive.
No, I definitely know he's alive. Hell of a Twitter follow. I wanted to say, like, we should send over, like, the 1985 Grand Final if he was in it and Warwick Kappa.
Yeah.
And just, like, let what happens come.
Yeah.
But he never won a Grand Final. But...
Two common medals.
Two common...
Which people forget.
Did he actually?
Yep.
That's huge.
See, people forget.
See, I did forget. And I'm a people. Cool. That is it for the show this week, I think. Is there anything else?
No.
Cool. That is it for the show this week. Thank you to Morgan Begg and Kurt Wallace for those interviews. Really interesting stuff. Make sure you're going to check out Morgan Begg's article in The Spectator Australia. Make sure you're checking out our articles on moving the embassy to Jerusalem. Andrew Bushnell's new report on criminal justice. Whole lot of stuff for you guys to read about the IPA this week. And thank you guys so much for listening and downloading. Make sure you're telling your friends and family about the show. Get the word out. Word of mouth, a really cool way of marketing podcasts, as I learned this week at Ozpod. And so make sure you're getting that out there. Make sure you're leaving us a 5-star review on iTunes. And Nina, if people want to join the IPA and donate to the IPA, where can they go?
Just go to our website, ipa.org.au, and click on the donate button if you want to donate, or click on the join button if you like to join, or sign up someone else that you know that haven't been a member. And by becoming a member starting as low as $22 a year, you become one of the loudest voice of freedom in Australia.
Very cool.
I think Warwick Kappa kicked 100 goals twice, not the common.
Okay. So... Sure. He would like, we'll come up in his Google alerts and he would email the show if we got that wrong.
Yeah.
And then he'd catch a plane to Saudi Arabia because I'm sure he'd just convinced himself that's a good idea.
Well, he could.
Good luck, Warwick. See you guys next week.
Stay up.